Well, we have two short readings from God's Word today, one in the Old Testament and one in the New. First of all, we are reading Psalm 14. Psalm 14 in the prose version in the middle of our Bibles. And the heading tells us it's a Psalm of David. Not all the Psalms were written by David, but very many of them were. The fool says in his heart, "There is no God. They are corrupt, their deeds are vile, there is no one who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven on the sons of men to see if there are any who understand, any who seek God. All have turned aside. They have together become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one. Will evildoers never learn? Those who devour my people as men eat bread, and who do not call on the Lord. There they are, overwhelmed with dread, for God is present in the company of the righteous. You evildoers frustrate the plans of the poor, but the Lord is their refuge. Oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion, and the Lord restores the fortunes of his people. Let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad." Then we turn over to the New Testament. We turn to Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 1. And we're reading from verse 18. Paul's been speaking about the gospel, how he's not ashamed of that gospel. It proclaims God's way of salvation. And so from verse 18, he spells out for us why that salvation is needed. "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth in their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God, nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen." Psalm 14, verse 1, begins with a very blunt statement. The fool says in his heart, "There is no God." And at first sight, that might seem a wrong-headed claim. Is that really the case? The fool says there's no God. Surely there are many highly educated people today who are saying there is no God. And indeed, it seems that there are more people than ever before denying the existence of God. There would appear in recent years to have been a tremendous upsurge in the rejection of belief in God. We have, for example, those who are termed the new atheists in recent years, people like Richard Dawkins, A.C. Grayling, and others, who have been very vocal in denying the existence of God, who have published numerous books, some weighty volumes, and who often are heard on the media, their faces would be known in a way that no other philosopher would be known, and probably no atheist of the past would be known. Can we take seriously the idea that those who say there's no God are fools? It appears to many people that in fact they are the educated, the opinion formers, the intellectual elite of our day. And of course, to some, that simply confirms just how out of date and irrelevant the Bible is. What a ludicrous idea to say that people who deny the existence of God are fools. Many of them are very well educated. Many of them intellectually are extremely capable. So many are saying there is no God. If we go back as far as 1981, which some of us can even remember, there was a television series called Cosmos by the astrophysicist Carl Sagan, and it was very popular at the time. And Sagan was one of the early leaders in this upsurge of atheism. And he made the comment, you can find it in his book if you care to look. He says, "The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be." That really is a manifesto for atheism, a denial that there's a God. The material cosmos is all there ever was, all there is, and all there ever will be. For Sagan and others, there was no need for a God to explain the cosmos. There's no place for a God in their worldview. He's superfluous. And we get a flavor of this outlook in the titles of some of the books these new atheists have been publishing. You don't need to say to them, "Come off the fence and tell us what you really think." It's very obvious. A.C. Grayling, British philosopher, you'll know him immediately you see him, the long flowing grey hair down to his shoulders. That's Grayling. One of Grayling's books was Against All Gods. You know what he thinks. And of course, not just the God of Christianity that they reject. It's the God of Islam, it's any God. But Christianity and Islam are the two big targets as far as these atheists are concerned. Another was Christopher Hitchens, a journalist, essayist, now dead and a better theologian now than he used to be. And he wrote a book called God Is Not Great: The Case Against Religion. In fact, for Hitchens, not only was God not great, God just didn't exist. And Richard Dawkins, the Archbishop of the New Atheists, if we can call him that, because Dawkins is an evangelist for atheism. He is not content to sit back and say, "Well, I don't believe, but you can believe, and it doesn't matter." He's out there promoting atheism as much as he possibly can. He is a real evangelist and a bit of an embarrassment, actually, to many atheists. One of Dawkins' books, 2006, was The God Delusion. And again, we know exactly what he thinks. And indeed, the main thesis of that book, the very heart of what The God Delusion was about, he puts it this way: God almost certainly does not exist. I'm not sure why he put in almost, because there's no almost in his head about God not existing. He's absolutely sure he doesn't. And one of Dawkins' favourites, he's a man for the caricature, one of his favourites is to compare belief in God to belief in the flying spaghetti monster. That's just one of those things that's Dawkins. That's the level, actually, of some of his discussion. You believe in God, it's like a child believing in a flying spaghetti monster. Ludicrous. To believe in God is to be a fool. And those thinkers we've been mentioning, and there are plenty of others, are what we call atheists. They deny that God exists and taken over the whole spread of human history. If you look back through history, atheists actually are quite a rare breed. We shouldn't be deceived by the apparent number of them at the moment. And of course, like other campaigners, they're very good at making their numbers seem bigger than they actually are. They're a rare breed historically until fairly recently, late 20th century into our own century. Really, there have been very few atheists. They've been pretty scarce. But there's been a bit of an upsurge in recent years. They're the ones who deny that God exists. More common than that variety of atheist, the kind of people that David the psalmist actually would have had more in mind when he wrote Psalm 14. Not so much the person who says there isn't a God at all. In the ancient world, very, very, very few people would have said that. But rather those that he describes at the beginning of Psalm 14, the fool who says there's no God, are people who wouldn't outright say no God exists, but they would say that if there is a God, he doesn't matter. He doesn't have any impact on my life. If there is a God, he's up there somewhere and he's irrelevant. That's the sort of person who lives his life as if there isn't a God. And whether there's one or not, it doesn't matter. It makes no difference to the way they conduct their lives. You might call them practical atheists. They might say God doesn't exist. They might say maybe he does. But at the proverbial end of the day, it doesn't matter. There's no God, as far as I'm concerned. There's no God as far as I live my life. And that is more the sort of person David has in view here. They conclude, if there is a God, he has no impact on my life. I can safely ignore him. If he's up in the sky, that's all right. I don't have to take him into account. But whichever kind of atheist it is, whether it's the sort of philosophical atheist like Dawkins, or the kind of practical atheist like a lot of people who walk past this church today and every day, whichever kind it is, they're really saying there's no God. Either he doesn't exist, or if he does, doesn't matter. I can ignore him. I live my life without taking any account of God. And that's the person that David says is a fool. The same verdict on whatever variety of atheist it happens to be, whether it's philosophical or practical. They're saying there's no God, and David, directed by the Spirit of God, says they're fools. They might look educated, they might sound educated, they're fools. Now, that isn't a comment on the intellectual capacity of the person who says this. It's not a comment on the amount of education that they have had. They might intellectually be very able. They might have a string of university degrees. They might be very eloquent, maybe able to write very well, speak very well. In the world's view, these are the leaders of thought. These are the wise men of our day. David says, don't be fooled. These are fools. They may have great intellectual capacity. They may have a splendid education behind them. But the verdict of God, because it's God's verdict that David is speaking, God's verdict is that man, that woman, that young person is a fool. That's what God thinks. And in the end, whose view matters but God's? That person is a fool. Well, what is a fool? We've said it isn't intellectual capacity, it isn't education that matters. So what is a fool in Bible language? Well, a fool in the Bible is the person who doesn't know how to live in a world that is made by God and that is governed by God. That's the fool. That's what the Bible means. You don't know how to live in a world that God has made and God governs. You've no idea. That is to be a fool. You may be very intelligent. You may be very well educated. But if you don't know how to live in a world that's made by God and governed by God, you are a fool. You don't know the right way to live. And it's very significant. David goes on immediately in the psalm to talk about the way these people live. This isn't a philosophical treatise he's writing. He says the person who believes there's no God and he's a fool, well, look at how he lives. Look at the life that results from saying there is no God. They are corrupt, their deeds are vile, there is no one who does good. It's how they live that shows you what they think. And indeed, if you look at the lives of many who deny the existence of God, they're a mess. And that's not a surprise. What you believe or what you don't believe shapes the way you live. That's exactly what David is telling us. To be a fool and to say there is no God has a tremendous impact on the life you live. And it's that shows these people are fools. To live your life without reference to God is the height of folly. It's not just a little issue. It's not a small thing. It's the biggest mistake you could ever make. It really is the height of folly. And to live your life without regard for God, whether you believe he exists or not, but to live as if he didn't, is really what the Bible means by sin. You see, we think of sins as perhaps murdering or stealing or things like that, and those are sins. But the real heart of sin, according to the Bible, is living without any reference to God. That's sin. And David says it's foolish. Utterly, utterly foolish. And yet there are many who say there is no God. But to say that and to mean it, well, you have to close your eyes to some very fundamental facts about the universe, about yourself. You see, sometimes people think, well, to find any evidence for the existence of God, you've got to rummage about and look for it in obscure corners, and there's maybe a little bit there, and there's maybe a little bit there, and you have to try and put it together to make up a case for God's existence, as if there was a shortage of evidence for the existence of God. And the truth is the very opposite. You open your eyes, and anywhere you look in the entire universe, there's evidence for God. It presses itself in upon us at every moment. You can't avoid it. unless you close your eyes to it and refuse to see it. It's there everywhere. You don't have to search. It is unmissable. And the person who says there's no God has to close their eyes to what's there, staring them in the face at every moment. And we shouldn't, for Christians, apologize for one moment for saying there's a God and that there is ample evidence for it. The entire universe is full of evidence. So what are these atheists closing their eyes to? They're closing their eyes, first of all, to creation. To creation. All around us is evidence for the existence of God. We sang Psalm 19 for obvious reasons. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. And now in our day, there is so much more evidence for the creation being God's handiwork. Sometimes you'll hear, well, you know, back in ancient times, people didn't know much about the universe, and so it was easier for them to believe there was a God. That's different for us in our scientific age. That's not the case. All the discoveries of science in the millennia since Psalm 14 was written, there is far, far more available to anybody to show the wonders of creation and the handiwork of God, whether it's right down to the microscopic level, even beyond that to the subatomic level, or right up to the universe, the Hubble telescope and the probes to the farthest reaches of the universe. We have so much evidence. It's everywhere. You couldn't avoid it. It's available to all of our senses. We don't have to search for it. It's there. And Paul writes in Romans 1:19, we read it earlier, what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. What's he made plain? Well, Paul goes on, Romans 1, verse 20. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. Paul says, look, listen. It's there, all around you. It's plain. God has made it plain. And then he draws a very important conclusion from that argument. He says, men are without excuse. They're without excuse. All the evidence that there is from the creation, every human being, whether they have ever opened a Bible or not, is without excuse for not believing there is a God and a God who should be worshipped and served. And when people stand before God at the last day, they will have no excuse. No excuse whatsoever. They'll not be able to say, ah, there wasn't enough evidence, Lord. You didn't make it clear. You can't blame me. There wasn't enough there to convince me. One of the great atheist philosophers of earlier days, when he was asked, what would he say to God if he met him? I said, not enough evidence. He knows better today. All the evidence anybody could need. There, pressed in upon us. Nobody has an excuse. Anybody who thinks they'll say to God at the last day, there wasn't enough evidence for your existence, is not going to be heard. Not going to be heard. Pathetic. So there's the creation. The atheist has to close his eyes to the creation. He also has to close his eyes to conscience, his own conscience. Everybody comes to a point where they want to say, where they insist on saying, that's not fair. That's not just. That point will always come. The person who says, well, I don't believe in moral absolutes. Everybody just chooses their own morality. There are no rules that apply to everybody. The day comes sooner or later when he will want to say, that's wrong. Maybe it's he who's been hurt. Maybe it's his family, his loved ones who are hurt. But he will want to say, that is wrong. That is not just. Not, I don't like it, but it's wrong. And it will come sooner or later. And it tells us that every human being has an inbuilt sense of morality that's exercised through their conscience. The conscience isn't a perfect guide. It needs to be educated. But everybody has a sense that some things are right, some things are wrong. Not just that they prefer some things to others, but some things are actually wrong. That's a moral judgment. Where does that sense of morality come from? Is it just the result of evolution? Is it just a way in which you and your genes are preserved? Is it just the result of social pressure that people conform? Well, when you analyze all of these explanations for morality, there's none of them satisfactory. There's something more at work. And we know what is at work. We know the explanation for that conscience, for that sense of morality in human beings. It's because we're made in God's image. We're made in the image of a God who is the standard of morality. In Romans 2, verses 14 and 15, Paul describes people who don't have a Bible. Gentiles, they don't have the Old Testament the Jews had. And he says these Gentiles who don't have the law, who don't have God's written word, but he says sometimes they do the things that are required by God's law. Why is that? And Paul explains. He says they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts. The requirements of God's law are written on their hearts. They've never read a Bible. They maybe don't even know a Bible exists, but they have a sense of right and wrong in their conscience. And the reason they have it is because God wrote it there when he made us in his image. They can't escape it. Nobody can escape the voice of conscience. Now, people do. They try to silence their conscience in all sorts of ways. We've seen that in this province as the result of the Troubles. And those who try to silence conscience with the drugs, with the alcohol, with all sorts of things, but their conscience won't shut up because God has put it there. And it won't be silent. And it tells them there is a God to whom you are accountable. And there's right and there's wrong. And God put that there. It's not just out in the creation that there's abundant evidence for God's existence. But in the conscience within us, there's a voice that God has put there. He has written the law on the human heart. Our moral sense points us to a moral lawgiver, to the God who has built that into us And as long as you are in the image of God, as long as you are human, then there is the evidence for his existence in the conscience, in your sense of right and wrong. So the atheist must close his eyes to creation, and he must close his eyes to conscience, and he must close his eyes to Christ. To Christ. Because the ultimate evidence for God's existence is the fact that he actually has walked on this earth among human beings in a human body. And he lived here, and he died on a cross. And we believe he rose because the tomb was empty. So Hebrews 1 and verse 2 puts it, in these last days, God has spoken to us by his Son. And Jesus was able to say in John 14 and verse 9, whoever has seen me has seen the Father. To see Jesus is to see God. To see him with your literal eyes, as the disciples did, to see him in the pages of the Bible, is to see God. And the only adequate explanation for the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, as it's recorded in the Bible, is that he was truly God. No other explanation stands up. And atheists and others have tried for centuries to come up with another explanation that explains Jesus without success. Only the truth we believe, that he is the Son of God in human flesh, walking on earth, dying, rising, that's the only explanation that can make sense of Jesus. God couldn't have given a clearer testimony to his existence than the person of Jesus Christ. And we might say the evidence for Jesus' existence is overwhelming. The days when some were inclined to say, well, we can't trust the Bible and we don't really know who Jesus was, that's pretty old hat these days. They've moved on quite a distance, actually, from that with regard to the trustworthiness of the New Testament record. Even those who don't trust in Christ are hard put to argue that the New Testament isn't really reliable. We've passed that. And when you get a Dawkins or somebody else trotting out the same old arguments, we don't really know who Jesus was, we can't trust the New Testament. Friends, that's way out of date. That tells you how out of touch some of these guys are. So the atheist has to close his eyes to creation and to conscience and to Christ. All the evidence you could ever need. Do you notice, as we've listed these different forms of evidence, we've been assuming something. We've been assuming that our human minds can process arguments, can use logic, can weigh up evidence, that our human minds are able to discern order in the universe and to hear the voice of conscience. We've trusted our minds. The new atheists and others trust their minds to argue, to debate, to reason, to produce evidence, to come to conclusions. They use their minds. We use our minds. But why should we trust them? Why should we trust a few pounds of grey matter in the skull of a fairly evolved ape? Because that's what Dawkins and others believe we are. Why should we trust the thinking of an intelligent ape? Why should we believe that reason and logic and ordered thinking mean anything? Because the atheist wants to argue they are. He wants to argue, doesn't he? Some of them love to argue. We've had them here in the past. We stood out in that street and argued with them and debated and reasoned. And they want to reason. They want to argue. They want to think logically. They trust their brain. They trust their mind. Why? Because the fact is, from the atheist point of view, they have no ground for trusting the products of their own mind. They have no warrant for relying on logic and reason and argument. None. They have no foundation. The only foundation for reason and argument and logic is the existence of a God who himself is the standard of logic and reason. We are really thinking God's thoughts after him. This expression Kepler the astronomer used, thinking God's thoughts after him. And when an atheist uses his mind and uses logic and reason to argue against the existence of God, what is he doing? He's borrowing our tools. He's borrowing God-given tools to argue God doesn't exist. Now, if that is not a fool, I don't know what is. The atheist, more than anybody else, saws off the branch he's sitting on. He says, with my logic and my reason, I say there's no God. And it's God who gave him the reason and the ability to use logic and to argue and to think. That's folly. That is the ultimate folly. To say there is no God, to argue against the existence of God, is to use tools God gave him. That's a fool. There is no bigger fool than that. Only on a Christian worldview have we any warrant for trusting logic and reason, because they come from God. And for the atheist to use the tools to say there's no God is to use something he's no right to use. And that is a fool. That is a complete fool. Only if God exists can we reason and argue. Only if God exists can the atheist argue there's no God. Think of the folly. And as a friend of mine often will say, and him an educated man. Ludicrous. In a sense, our first response to the new atheists should be to laugh. Because it is a big joke to use your mind, your reason, and logic to say there's no God. Because the only place you could get them from is God. The fool really is a fool. There's no greater folly than that. And he can have a string of degrees. He can come from the best universities in the face of the earth. He can have a wonderful mind. But if he concludes there's no God, he really is a fool. He can only do what he's doing because God exists. A dead atheist is a wise man. Too late. Too late. Some of those we've named today are better theologians than we are. Too late. Let's make sure we are not fools. Oh, you, I'm sure, if I asked, you wouldn't say God doesn't exist. But are you living your life as if he doesn't exist, as if he doesn't matter? You don't have to take him into account. God says you're a fool. And if God says you're a fool, you really are. Only in Christ is there wisdom and life and purpose and meaning and logic and reason and all the things that are so precious to us. Don't be a fool.